Well, that's our episode on 12 Monkeys. Thank you so much for joining us. I really hope you enjoyed it.
Wait, Brian! We need to go back! We need to go back and do the episode!
Where the hell did you come from?
This is Junk Food Cinema.
Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema on Film School Rejects. Who are these guys?
All you nutcase lunatic maniac devils, and welcome to another episode of Junk Food Cinema. This is Film School Reject's weekly cult and exploitation film cast that is so crazy it just has to be good. Or something like that.
Something.
I am your host, Brian Salisbury. Please make the voices stop. And I am joined by my friend and co-host, novelist, screenwriter, the cordially insane, Mr. C. Robert Cargill. I want to remind you that this podcast is available on iTunes as well.
Well, that's the craziest fucking thing you've done so far.
What's that?
That's just kind of creepy. Like, that's your Charles Bronson serial killer voice.
Oh, yeah. iTunes as well as Stitcher. And if you want to follow us on Twitter, you can at...
Stop rubbing your nipples!
No, I will not. Look me in the eye when I make eye contact
with
you. No! At Junk Food Cinema. You can also like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com. Hold on.
Facebook.com/junkfoodcinema.
It puts lotion on the skin and puts it in the basket.
Put the fucking podcast in your ears!
March Madness still plagues Junk Food Cinema with no cure in sight.
As does beer, apparently.
As does a lot of beer. I apologize if this goes a little off the rails. We have maybe been drinking. We will therefore ignore our neighbor's dog's advice and continue to highlight and celebrate our favorite psychos, schizos, and madmen in film. Today's cinematic dose of crazy is the supremely excellent 12 Monkeys.
What year is this?
What year do you think it is?
1996.
That's the future, James. Do you think you're living in the future?
I am simply trying to gather information to help the people in the present trace the path of the virus.
We're not in the present now.
The unbelievably excellent, one of the best time travel movies of all time, great 12 Monkeys. This is a movie that has a very interesting place in history. Terry Gilliam does not make hit movies.
Not so much.
This is our second Terry Gilliam film that we've covered.
Yep.
And by the time we've gotten sick of each other, I hope to have covered all but two of them.
Well, I think it's funny that we started with the two time traveling Terry Gilliam movies.
Well, to be fair, those are two, you know, those are easily two of the best.
Absolutely.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I love Brazil. I love
And Zero I love Fear and Loathing. So.
And I love Fear and Loathing. But these two films are just, they're so accessible to the mainstream and so brilliant at what they do. And this film has a brilliance that not everybody gets. That people get that it's weird and don't quite understand the level of just how weird it is. And the people that do, it's one of those movies that it's like, holy shit, this movie is perfect. This movie is great. People that don't always feel like there's something missing because this movie leaves out a chief, tiny little, seemingly insignificant piece of information that once you know that, changes the structure of the whole film, and the whole film just becomes amazing.
Which is ironic because Bruce Willis's character, they keep saying that his mission is to acquire information. That's what he's doing. I mean, the basic plot here, and I'm going to say basic to the nth degree because it gets super complicated, but the basic overarching plot is that you have this post-apocalyptic future, a world ravaged by disease takes place, although it's never stated, takes place in the year 2035. And so they have acquired the ability to time travel, and they send this man, played by Bruce Willis, the character...
Bruce Willie!
His name is James Cole. They send him back in time to gather information on the group that may or may not have been responsible for the release of the virus that killed almost the entire population of the Earth.
Yeah.
That's where we start.
Yes.
And from there, we weave in timelines, we weave in subtext, we weave in the possibility of complete madness superseding truth.
Yeah.
And Terry Gilliam just presses go.
Yes. And it's but at the same time, it's a culturally important film because it is a film that it was the breaking point for Brad Pitt. Brad Pitt is in this movie as a supporting player. You know, we've mentioned Bruce Willis. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, he stars opposite Madeline Stowe. And supporting him is this character who flows throughout the narrative, played by Brad Pitt. Now, up until this moment, when Brad Pitt shot this movie, he wasn't a star.
That's correct.
He was the guy who was smoking weed out of a honey bear on the couch in True Romance.
Yeah.
You know, this is who he was. And but to those
he
of
was,
us,
he was the eye candy from Thelma and Louise.
Well, that was just it. Is to us cinephiles, we knew exactly who he was because there were two types of people who knew him: cinephiles and 14-year-old girls. He was, you know, the eye candy in The Favor. He was the eye candy in Thelma and Louise. Up until this point, he was this guy who was a pair of abs who was put in, you know, films with, you know, to be pretty. You know, he's also the guy who was in Cool World. So, you know, he was not a guy who was high up on our esteem list.
It's sad to me that nobody at the time was like, oh yeah, third lead from Cutting Class with Jill Sholin.
Yes. So,
well, fine. Nobody was like, that's fine, whatever. Nobody remembers Cutting Class.
But when he had this run in 95 where he started having these hit films come out. And Seven was this film where people were like, oh, hey, look, here's this guy. He's becoming an A-lister. He's in all these movies. But cinephiles, the nerds in particular, were just like, yeah, he's still just a pair of abs. He's not cool. He's just a new pretty boy. He's, you know who he's, and in fact, this is the sweet irony of the 90s. This is what it was like to live in the 90s. This is Johnny Depp all over again.
Oh my God.
Like, he's just a pretty boy. Like, this is, and so he kept choosing these really peculiar movies, much to the consternation of his agent. And then he shows up in 12 Monkeys. And here, this is the movie that we all walked out of and said, holy shit, that guy's a genius.
Really? Even after Seven, people just thought he was
ridiculous. There were arguments about it because Seven, but the thing is that's looking with retrospect. Mm. At the time, you know, there's not a lot of range to his character in Seven. And until you've seen a lot of Brad Pitt roles, you don't understand the level of genius in Seven. Up until that point, we saw pretty boy Brad Pitt and then dark, menacing, married to Gwyneth Paltrow, which could have been the reason why he was dark and brooding Brad Pitt.
Hey-o.
12 Monkeys was where we saw the level of range and ability, because in this movie, there's a reason why he won the Oscar for this movie. And he won the Oscar, right? Not just nominated for it?
Brad Pitt won the Oscar for 12 Monkeys?
Or was he just nominated? I'm fact checking that.
He was nominated, did not.
He was nominated,
win.
Yeah. He was nominated for it. It was one of those that you look back in retrospect and it's like, oh shit, really? Really? You passed up giving an award to Brad Pitt for 12 Monkeys?
Right.
Like a career defining role? And he's just brilliant in this. And he just, he melted brains. And all the nerds I knew walked out of it and said, just holy shit, that guy's the real deal. Like, we've been shit. It was a profound moment because it's like, holy shit, we've been shitting on this guy for years, joking that he's just a pair of abs. And he's been this great actor all along, taking whatever shit role he can find to prove himself. And now he has. And then from that point on, post 12 Monkeys, nobody questioned Brad Pitt's acting. Mm-hmm. Like, even when he hit a kind of like a dry run in the late 90s, everyone's like, oh, he's still a genius. And then he did Snatch, and everyone's like, holy fuck again. And then the, you know, you have that turn that then leads him into being the A-list super celeb that he is now, to where if Brad Pitt shows up in a movie, you're going to fucking watch it. But this was that movie. Mm-hmm. And he's so great in this movie that he overshadows how great fucking Bruce Willis is in this movie.
And we're going to talk about both those guys, because in every episode of this March Madness theme, we've been talking about the specificity of crazy. And what's great about 12 Monkeys is you have several different specific types of crazy all interacting at once, all affecting the outcome of the storyline.
Well, and the storyline itself, and this ties into what I was saying, you know, very early on in this episode, the primer to fully understanding 12 Monkeys is all about the crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, let's go into that now, because let me talk about why I think this is one of those truly brilliant science fiction films.
Okay.
12 Monkeys sets up that 5 billion people die in 1996 from a virus that is let loose And kills all but about 1% of the population.
Super nitpicky detail. It's actually 1997. They send him back. They're trying to send him back to 1996 to prevent.
Yes, November of 96 is when he goes to prevent, because that's when the virus is released.
Right. And then
in November of 96.
Yeah.
So but 97 is when everyone dies.
Exactly. Yeah. Not to be anal. I'm just getting the timeline.
The key point there is in the big clue is in it kills all but 1% of the population. About 1% of the population is also the number of people in the world that suffer from schizophrenia. So what he's created and what you see of the future and what you get out of this movie is Bruce Willis lives in a future where the only people to survive a virus all suffer from schizophrenia and have tried to rebuild their post-apocalyptic post-virus world, and they're all out of their fucking minds.
Which explains a lot of things. Which explains things like why, when they put him in the bio suit to go out and collect samples, he looks like a junkyard cosmonaut.
Yeah.
Like, it's just plastic bags, and like, it's clearly not based on any real science. And the thing to remember is that they're still operating off of 1997 technology, because that's the last thing that they knew.
Yeah.
And yet, the things that they're using, the various methods and the various machinations are not any, they don't look 90s, they just look crazy.
Yes, because those are the only people who survived. And these people are having a very tough time recreating society when they all have voices in their head and none of them know what's real. And so when they go and they're looking for what they refer to as the strongest people, the people with the strongest minds to go back in time, what they're looking for is the least crazy people.
Yeah.
In this post-apocalyptic future, who suffer from schizophrenia, to go back in time to do this mission.
Yes. And why is it they choose Bruce Willis specifically? Because he can remember a phone number.
Yes.
They choose Bruce Willis to go on the mission because he can remember one phone number. That's it. That's the whole reason.
You're good at remembering things. Go back and call this number.
That's it. That's the whole reason he's sent.
Because they're out of their fucking mind. And
right.
That's what I find so brilliant about this movie. Essentially, I mean, there are those of you, I know there's those of you out there right now who are gnashing your teeth going, why haven't they said the words La Jetée yet? Why haven't they said La Jetée? Because this movie was based very heavily on the short, you know, 60s French post-apocalyptic movie La Jetée, which is a brilliant, strange experimental film that is not for everybody. It's not a junk food cinema movie.
No, but we are going to talk in a moment about a scene in 12 Monkeys that brings the entire thing, La Jetée and the lineage of 12 Monkeys, completely full circle.
Yes, but so it's built heavily upon La Jetée, and it references it because it steals the time travel elements. But what Gilliam does with that little bit of hidden information in that movie, the fact that he never actually says in the movie that everyone in the future is schizophrenic, but that's the movie he makes. And it is brilliant. And for those of you who have ever watched the movie and gone, that movie was just weird for the sake of being weird, take that piece of information that I just gave you, go back and watch it, knowing that only schizophrenics survive, and all of a sudden, every scene in that movie makes 100% sense, and it's genius. And it's like, holy fuck. Look, I know Brazil is the big centerpiece for geeks when it comes to Gilliam, and I know that the stuff he did with Monty Python was brilliant and amazing. I contend that 12 Monkeys is the single most brilliant piece of cinema the man has ever made.
And I'm just going to throw this out there. I love this way more than Brazil. 12 Monkeys, to me, I'm so much more invested in it. It really does grab me, and you know, I want to talk a little bit about the production of this movie, because you mentioned La Jetée, and what you have here is you have the screenplay being written by David Peoples. David Peoples is also the man who adapts Philip K. Dick's Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep,
yep,
and writes the screenplay for Blade Runner. And so when Gilliam signs on to the movie, he himself had never seen La Jetée. But he had read the script for this movie, and what he identifies is a lot of similar themes to Brazil. A lot of things that he recognizes that made him fall in love with the movie, with wanting to do Brazil. So he hops on board. Now, his original idea was to cast Jeff Bridges as the Brad Pitt character,
yes,
and Nick Nolte as the Bruce Willis character.
It's a very, very, very different fucking movie.
So different. But what's really mind-blowing about this is that that he would want to work with Universal again in the first place.
Yes.
Because he and Universal had this famously acrimonious relationship over the production of Brazil. And a lot of that, however, was the fact that they wanted him to change the ending. That's why there's like three different cuts of that movie, is Universal didn't like the ending of Brazil and they wanted it changed. But on this movie, because the person who was in charge of the project, the person who was the biggest backer, was very pro-Gilliam, they gave him Final Cut. And when he got Final Cut, he decided to do the movie again with Universal. So after the initial idea of Nick Nolte and Jeff Bridges falls apart, now Jeff Bridges he'd worked with on Fisher King, he casts Bruce Willis, which is a slam dunk, right? Movie easily made now. Awesome. Well, there was a snag. And the snag was a little movie called Waterworld. Waterworld was so over budget and had so many problems on set that the studio was wary of fast-tracking another big sci-fi flick. But the final piece of the puzzle was Willis agreeing to take a pay cut to do the movie, because all Willis wanted was to work with Gilliam.
Yeah.
So he takes a major pay cut, basically worked for free. He got points on the back end, but he didn't get paid anything.
And this movie did do well.
And this movie made five times its budget.
Yes.
So it definitely did well. But I mean, you're talking about somebody so invested in working with a filmmaker that they're willing to take no money up front. And when the studio heard that, that's when this movie gets fast-tracked. And sure enough, Gilliam himself, at a test screening, the audience did not react well to the ending. And he toyed with the idea of changing the ending and then decided to stick with it. And true to their word, Universal did not interfere. So that's why we have the 12 monkeys that we have now.
Well, and on top of that, something that goes along with that was the fact that this movie was made, I believe the budget was an odd number, $29.5 million.
Exactly, $29.5 million. Look at you, Rain Man.
And the weird thing about it is Gilliam had gotten so knocked around on Munchausen. Baron Munchausen was a big disaster in his career. It's something he doesn't like to talk about. It's such a weird, it has such a weird place.
Yeah.
I have a fondness in my heart, but then again, it's one of those movies I watched as a child. It was a children's film about growing up, and it exactly at the age I was, I was the perfect age for it. So he really did make a film for me. And so I love it. I understand that others don't. But he had gotten so knocked around on how over budget that went that apparently that he was just like, that is the number. We are not going over it. We are not spending a single dime over 29.5 million, and which is why that number is still quoted today. So when you're somebody who is a director who is so playing by the rules like that, and you have Final Cut, the studio is going to give you a lot of leeway, because they're like, look, we've already done the math. We know you have Bruce Willis in this. So it's going to do well. And we're going to make our money back. You don't go over that number, have whatever fucking ending you want. And then, of course, they lucked into the fact that this guy that he hired as, you know, the crazy guy in this movie turned out to have hit after hit after hit right before this opened,
yeah,
launching this into the stratosphere, and it made like over 180 million worldwide in the 90s.
Yeah.
Which is
nothing
huge
to sneeze at. Nothing
it's
to sneeze
huge.
At.
Not even nothing to sneeze at. 180 million in the 90s. Worldwide is fucking gargantuan. Mm-hmm. Like, that is big money. So this movie did incredibly well for being one of those, but for being a weird fucking Gilliam film that lacks that information. If you were to make that movie today, if you were to make 12 Monkeys today, the studio would look at it and go, I don't get it. Why is everybody in the future crazy? And you tell them, oh, because the only people that survived are schizophrenics. Well, why the fuck didn't you tell everybody that? Why is that not a line in the dialogue?
But there's so many moments throughout the course of time traveling to these different eras that connect those dots, and they connect, yeah, them in such a really subtle way. One of my favorite moments is that at a certain point, okay, so the basic, I don't know how we want to break this down, but he's first sent back to 1990.
Yes, on accident.
Because one of the great themes in a lot of Terry Gilliam movies is the idiocy of bureaucracy.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a bureaucracy in the time travel where they can't seem to get it right, sending him back to the... First, they're trying to send him to 1996.
Yes.
First, they overshoot and send him to 1990. And the second time, they're like, don't worry, we got the kinks worked out. We're sending you to 1996 on the nose. They send him back to World War I France.
They send him back to 1917.
Whoops. Not quite correct. But in 1990, he's in an asylum. He's been captured. He's been arrested, and then, of course, they think he's crazy because he's talking about this future and this virus that's going to wipe out the planet, animals running free in the post-apocalyptic universe, and blah 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 blah. So they lock him up, and that's where he meets Brad Pitt's character, who's another inmate. And there's this great. They're watching a cartoon. They're watching an old Woody Woodpecker cartoon.
Yep.
And in the Woody Woodpecker cartoon, this sort of broadly drawn German scientist is like, I have invented this time tunnel, which will allow me to travel to... And you look at it, and you're like, that looks a lot like the thing he just traveled back in time in. And it's then, from a Woody Woodpecker cartoon.
And then Gilliam does that visually throughout the entire movie by not only juxtaposing pop culture into it, but by... there's this great shot where he's trapped. He's locked in this room where Bruce Willie is locked in because I can't say Bruce Willis anymore. It's Bruce Willie.
How about that Bruce Willie though?
Bruce Willie is my. Bruce Willis is locked in this room and he's strapped to this table and he's looking up at this light and then all of a sudden, and he's looking at this other light that looks a lot like that light, but from the future.
It's a future light.
It's a future light. And then you're just like, what the fuck? And there's this weird, it's all the weird future stuff comes. It's like, oh, he's having a psychotic break. He's really crazy. I've been lied to. And then we have this scene where everybody walks into the room and he's gone. And it's like, I don't know what I'm supposed to believe here.
Exactly. And those are the moments that I think I love the best, because you think you have it pegged. You think, oh, absolutely. I mean, and I think this is a good time as any to get into the specificity of crazy, because we have three different crazy. Really, we have two main crazy and one side crazy here.
I'll have an order of big crazy with a little side crazy.
A little side of crazy. Crazy bread? No, just crazy. So,
I had a girl that was a side of crazy for a while.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Had to work out for you.
Crazy.
Yeah, I figured as much. You have all these moments where you're like, okay, absolutely, all this is his, the ramblings of a lunatic. And another one of my favorite signatures is that if you look at the panel of scientists, they're just, and their characters are credited as like botanist, electrician, astrophysicist. They don't even have names.
Yeah.
They're just a panel of scientists, and there are five of them. And then when he gets to 1990 and he's being interviewed by a panel of doctors, it's the same number, and they're laid out very similarly.
Yes.
And then when Madeline Stowe comes into the picture, when he goes back to the future, there's now a sixth scientist on that panel. So, like, you just start charting all of these similarities and all these things that are going on. Like,
and we see his dream at the beginning of the movie, and then once we meet Madeline Stowe, Madeline Stowe's in the dream.
Yes.
And the movie does, the movie really does ask you how much of this movie is real and how much is in Bruce Willis's mind.
Yeah, but there are things you can't ignore.
Right.
And there are things you don't have answers for, like when they end up in 1996 together and she digs a bullet out of his leg, a police officer played by Christopher Maloney with a lot of hair.
With a lot of hair.
A lot of hair.
It really is. It's funny because that's the one scene in the movie that kind of doesn't hold up in the same cinematic way, simply because you're like, wait, when did Madeline Stowe wander into an episode of CSI or not
Law and Order SVU?
SVU. Like it feels like that set, and it's Christopher Maloney, and he's doing the Christopher Maloney that I bet you this gig got him SVU. They're like, yeah. Oh yeah, you're the cop from the Gilliam film.
Yeah.
And
he tells her that the bullet that they dug out, that she supposedly dug out of Bruce Willis's leg, hadn't been fired since before the 1920s.
Yeah.
So it's like, and he's in the history books, his picture's there, he knows about the little kid faking the, falling down the pipe. He's like, no, he's just hiding, he's playing a prank, which I think is the proto balloon boy, and is very prescient indeed. But I mean, there are all these things you can't ignore.
Oh yeah, I totally forgot. You know what? Until you mentioned it, I totally forgot about Balloon Boy.
Balloon Boy.
Balloon Boy really happened.
It did really happen.
That was not a dream I had.
That is not a dream.
Balloon Boy is a dream we all shared.
You are not crazy. That actually happened.
I'd forgotten about Balloon Boy.
But at the same time, the thing about Bruce Willis's character is that he's sane. He seems sane, but he's the product of a broken world, a dystopian nightmare, like we said, where the 1% that survived are all schizophrenic. And, you think of him as the one sane person in the insane world. I mean, that's a very dystopian thing. That's a very dystopian trope, is that it's dystopian.
Dystropia.
Where you have one guy who seems to be You know, he's the guy that everybody else thinks is crazy, but he's really just the one who's sane and the whole world has gone crazy. I mean, it's very much like Dr. Lang's theory about psychopaths that we talked about in Alone in the Dark, where it's just they cannot reconcile living in a psychopathic world. That's kind of where his character is coming from. So even though we have so many reasons to suspect that there's something not right about the way he sees the world, he's also the one on this mission that seems to be so in the right and seems to know everything that's going on. And there are so many things that you can't deny, him disappearing, the bullet in his leg, all of it, knowing about Pipe Boy, Balloon Boy, that you don't know. Like, you can't ever make a definitive call on whether or not he's crazy.
Yeah, until you get to about the end of the movie.
Until you get to the end of the movie. Now, the other crazy, the Brad Pitt crazy.
The Brad Pitt crazy.
There is absolutely no denying that Jeffrey, which is the character that Brad Pitt plays, is out of his goddamn gourd.
Yes. Yes, I mean, he's fucking nuts.
He's frantic, he's wild, and he's the funny thing is he's very self-assured in all of his rambling. Like, he categorizes the world in such an interesting and fun way that it's like, yeah, it makes no sense, but it kind of makes sense.
Yeah, and you see where everything, like, links together in a weird way with him. Like, you know, when he decides, for no reason whatsoever, he's going to help Bruce Willis break out.
Yeah.
And he comes up and he sits down next to him, and, it you know, he's watching TV, and it's like, and now we return to monkey business. He goes, oh!
Monkey, get
monkey,
it? Monkey!
Monkey!
And he
monkey!
The key.
Monkey!
Yeah.
And then he then goes on to create the army of the 12 monkeys.
Well, and that's the interesting part, too, is there's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecy stuff going on in this movie.
Yes.
Because Bruce Willis is convinced that the virus was spread by a group called the Army of the 12 Monkeys, and that somebody in this asylum might be involved in that, so he starts talking about it, and lo and behold, gives Brad Pitt's character the idea for the Army of the 12 Monkeys in the first place, something he had never considered before. But, you know, but the thing about Jeffrey, about Brad Pitt's character, is he reminds me a lot of Johnny Depp's Raoul Duke from Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, because he wanders around and he's very frantic and he does a lot of movement at the wrist and of the head, but at the same time he's like he's a conspiracy nut but he's spouting things that sound like things that Raoul, like the board games. There's so many board games.
See? More games. Games, they vegetize you. See? Yeah. If you play the games, you're voluntarily taking a tranquilizer.
That's don't how they get the, you. Don't play the board games.
Don't play the board games. Like, I could totally see Raoul Duke being like, Jesus Christ, don't play the board games, especially with a head full of acid. You know, like, there's just something very similar about
this. This is bad country.
This is bad country. This is very much bad country. And funny enough,
glad we got rid of him. He had a wooden hand. He was running around. He had a wooden hand. But he was just tense.
I would love to watch those two movies back to back. But
you had two Terry Gilliam movies?
Well, yeah.
It's almost as if they belong together.
It's almost as if
they were made in sequential order together.
They could have been. Ass. But the thing is, like, Brad Pitt spent a lot of time before they started making this movie at the Temple University psychiatric ward of the hospital. And he's learning a lot of tics. Terry Gilliam sent him to a speech therapist or a speech coach to get, he was afraid Brad Pitt wouldn't be able to do the really frantic, you know, style of speech that he wanted. And then Terry Gilliam realized that Brad Pitt was a smoker, so he just took his cigarettes away. That's how he got him to, like, be that way. He just took his fucking cigarettes away.
That's brilliant.
And I'm like, why did you waste so much time with speech coaches and visit? Just take, apparently all you have to do is take a cigarette.
Except, first of all, let's just put this out there. Brad Pitt plus taking cigarettes away, plus training in a mental facility, creates one of the greatest crazy performances of all time.
Yeah.
Brad Pitt outdoes everything in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which is considered to be the high watermark of films about insanity. And he's amazing.
Well, and it's fun too, because we get to watch that crazy progress. As we time travel Bruce Willis, we get to see the various levels. And one of my favorite scenes is when he goes back and you realize that his father is this famous virologist played by Christopher Plummer. And they're at a very
one of our deep fried favorites.
Indeed. They're at this very fancy banquet and Bruce Willis just kind of stumbles in trying to figure out what's going on. And sure enough, you know, Jeffrey is at the banquet in a tuxedo, like nothing has changed.
In a tuxedo, dressed as sensitive ponytail guy, because we're no longer in 1990, we're now in 1996, where everybody was sensitive ponytail guy.
And then once Bruce Willis gets him alone, he realizes he's exactly as crazy, he's just learned to hide it,
yeah.
Which is even more frightening, and it thickens the plot of the Army of the 12 Monkeys and what they're going to do, because at this point, Bruce Willis is convinced Jeffrey is the leader of the Army of the 12 Monkeys.
He's even seen it in his dream. Proving that the dreams change.
Yes,
which makes that whole concept, the Lajete concept that they borrowed, questionable.
Because now all of a sudden he remembers part of the dream where someone running through the airport has a ponytail. It's like you can start to think, well, maybe he's just picking up elements that he sees and it's getting incorporated into the dream. Maybe the dream is not a portent. Maybe the dream is just a dream. And again, all of these things are happening at this. There are all these plates spinning at once, and Gilliam never lets a single one drop.
No.
And
no.
I love that.
And this is why I think of his films, this is easily his best film, because everything in this film, if you think something in this doesn't work, you haven't quite wrapped your mind all the way around everything. And I don't say that to be pretentious. I mean that, like, if you...
You're not saying you don't get it.
No, yeah, no, it's not, it's, if you still, if there's still a scene in this movie that doesn't totally jive with the rest of this movie, you need to go back and watch this movie again. Because this movie, all of the answers are there, and they are brilliantly there, and this mm-hmm. is one of those greatest science fiction films ever made that doesn't quite ever get the credit of being one of the greatest science fiction films ever made.
I agree. And I think it's really sad that that's the case. I don't quite know why. Maybe it's because, as we said before, Terry Gilliam is not a hit filmmaker.
I honestly, I think it's the 1% detail. I think that's the you know, anyone who like you has gone to school and taken, majoring in psychology, you know, anybody who's got a degree, anybody who's spent time around it, who knows that, anyone who's stumbled across that detail goes, oh, 1%. Oh, he's a schizophrenic. They highlight schizophrenia at the beginning. Everyone in the future seems to be exhibiting schizophrenia. Holy shit, 1% of the population has schizophrenia. That's the primer. If you don't have that primer, I feel like a lot of people walked out of this movie going, what the fuck was up with that crazy future? Oh, it's Terry Gilliam. He does weird stuff. And that's not what this one is. This is not Terry Gilliam being weird for the sake of being weird. This isn't, you know, wacky and the wackiness of Time Bandits. This is hard sci-fi. This is Terry Gilliam doing a very interesting riff on hard sci-fi and then taking one tiny detail out to make it come across as weird and zany. But everything in this movie pieces together in a way that's just mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. And it is one of those films that it's like, why is this not one of those movies that is heralded as one of the greatest dystopian science fiction films of all time?
Wackos everywhere, plague of madness.
And I really love the thematic elements that Terry Gilliam weaves into this. That, I mean, maybe credit is more due there to David Peoples, who wrote the script, but to kind of showcase crazy from so many different points of reference, from historical references to biblical reference to mythological references to literary references. I mean, you have the whole, she gives this great speech about apocalypse, and Madeline Stowe gives this great speech about apocalypse into the world, and talks about in Revelations that there will be vials that contain the wrath of God. I mean, Revelations is basically talking about chemical warfare. It's talking about these vials that contain the wrath of God, which becomes it becomes a signpost, something very important later on in the film. And then they also talk about Cassandra, which is a really interesting Greek myth about a woman who was blessed with knowing the future, but cursed with the fact that nobody would ever believe what she said, which is so Bruce Willis's character.
It's from the Aeneid. And anyone who's watched Troy, you've seen that character before on screen.
Right. And then, of course, in the historical references, World War I, the reason specifically that he ends up there is because World War I is when chemical warfare first became a part of warfare. I mean, the mustard gas of World War One.
That's where he shows up. He shows up during a mustard gas attack.
Exactly. And that's why they're all wearing the gas masks. And again, so much better equipped than the future version of Bruce Willis, who is wearing garbage bags and gloves. And then, of course, here's the really fun one, is that there's a very subtle reference to L. Frank Baum, the Magic of Oz in particular, because the title of the film, the 12 Monkeys, the Army of the 12 Monkeys, comes from this book in which the Gnome King convinces 12 monkeys that they will have an endless supply of food if they become human soldiers for the Gnome King. So you've got all these various references to really crazy things and really ugly things that human beings are capable of doing to one another. And it's all woven into three or four different timelines operating at once. And I don't, maybe, and I can totally understand it getting confusing, but for me, it's like, this movie is like music. Yeah. And once you start going along measure to measure and you get into the, and I don't mean to go J.K. Simmons here, but once you get on the right tempo, you get on the tempo.
Whiplash.
Tempo.
Brought to you by Blumhouse.
My tempo. once you get on Gilliam's tempo, you just kind of flow with this like music. And by the end of it, it's so beautiful the way it wraps up, the way it bookends, the way every bit of self-fulfilling prophecy is revealed. Oh my God, I love this movie so much.
Yeah. Yeah, no, this is a perfect science fiction film. It is, in fact, it's the weird thing about it is the level of intellectualism that goes into it. It's shocking that it came out of the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
This is a movie that belongs in the 70s, but wouldn't be as good in the 70s. It belongs exactly in the 90s. And it is just perfect. It is not a film like we were talking about last week where, you know, we were talking about 10 to Midnight,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, I said this would be, you know, 10 to Midnight would be a perfect film to be updated, to be remade, because it's a film that's flawed and could be brought to audiences a new way. You can show 12 Monkeys to people today who have not seen it 20 years later, who are gonna fucking fall in love with this movie.
This falls way more on the cult side of our core values. This is not a cheesy film.
No.
This is not an exploitation film. This is not a film that you should appreciate with any level of irony. This is just a film that I feel, and I'm sure Cargill agrees, has never really gotten its proper due.
No. In fact, it's one of those, it frustrates me because, you know, you ask people about greatest science fiction films of the 1990s, they're gonna mention Terminator 2. Course, they're going to mention Jurassic Park. They're going to mention Total Recall. They're not going to mention 12 Monkeys. 12 Monkeys, I think, is better than all of those. Yes, I just said
you
12
said
Monkeys is better than Jurassic Park.
Whoa.
Go fuck yourself if you think differently.
Strong words. Bold words.
No disrespect to those of you who love Jurassic Park.
And seriously, there are a lot of you.
There are a lot of
you. Because it's a great movie.
This, I think, is among the very best. You know, one of the other ones would be mentioned is The Matrix. I put this up there with The Matrix. I think The Matrix is the mainstream version of this fucking movie. But this is, it's not an art film. It's not just a weird film. It is cinema.
Yeah.
And it is great sci-fi cinema. It is so fucking smart. It is so well executed. There's nothing, you know, the look of it is dated in that it is very of its time, but even then it looks slick for its time.
Yeah.
Like, this movie 20 years later holds the fuck up, and it's so fucking brilliant. I think it is a perfect sci-fi film.
Well, and I think it's an interesting double feature with Terminator 2 and the Terminator franchise, because it too is about trying to stop
Harlan Ellison.
What's that?
I said rips off Harlan Ellison.
Well, you know, whatever. It's one of those things that it too is about trying to stave off apocalypse, and about this sort of circular causality that leads us to that, and how like the things that characters are doing to try and prevent the apocalypse are also cobblestones in the road to getting to that apocalypse in the first place.
Yeah.
So I think there are elements that you could really see like a spiritual connection between those two movies. So it's really interesting that while Terminator 2 is so revered, 12 Monkeys is one of those films that is largely forgotten. And that's very unfortunate.
People remember it as being a Brad Pitt, Bruce Willis film, but they don't remember how genius it is. If this is a movie you haven't watched in 15, 20 years or 10 years, go back and rewatch this movie now. This movie's fucking good.
And I want to talk just a couple more things about Terry Gilliam's direction that I really love in this movie. One of the things is how he deals with Bruce Willis. He apparently, when the bottom fell out on Jeff Bridges and Nick Nolte, he decided to go with Bruce Willis because he saw Die Hard, and he was particularly impressed with the scene where John McClane is talking tenderly about his wife and he's picking glass out of his feet. And then when Gilliam found out that scene was largely ad-libbed, he knew Willis was his guy. But that being said, He gave Bruce Willis a list when he got on set of Bruce Willis acting cliches that he was not allowed to do throughout the course of the entire filming.
It would be like giving a single piece of paper to Harrison Ford that says, you're not allowed to point at another human being. Like, you're just not. Like, you cannot point at another human being. Like, that's it. Go.
Well, I mean, to me, it was very similar to what happened when Steven Soderbergh started working with George Clooney. And he's like, George, let me... And just grabs George Clooney's head and he's like, stop it. Stop with the bobbly head thing. I don't like it. What are you doing?
And that's what George Clooney went from being TV actor to being George fucking Clooney.
And that's...
By just going, just hold that there.
Exactly.
In one place.
Apparently, one of the things Gilliam wouldn't let Bruce Willis do was what he called the steely blue eye look. Which, if you watch every Bruce Willis movie, you will see a scene where he just, like, stares really intensely at the camera and is just like, that's all it is. It's just like, look at Bruce Willis's eyes.
Yeah.
That's it. That's the whole scene. So he took that away from him. So I think it's funny that between that and the taking away the cigarettes from Brad Pitt to get the right twitchiness out of him, like, Gilliam is very hands-on and very bold when it comes to working with actors, no matter at what point in their career they are. He's fearless.
Keep in mind that this was a guy that worked with some of the most brilliant comedians of all time. Like, I would hold that Eric Idle and John Cleese are two of the single greatest comedians of all time.
True.
And then when no you start, and like, if you're making a top five, it's hard to make a top five without one of them in there. It's impossible to make a top 10 without two of them in there. And then when you start making the top 20, that's where Michael Palin and, Graham Chapman start falling into place. But he's somebody who worked with comedians all the time and had to find out, and he was often their director. Mm-hmm. He was the guy that was kind of behind the scenes putting a lot of stuff together, and he had to figure out a way to get the funny out of these guys by capturing the moment. And I feel like his work with Monty Python really did teach him to be fearless with actors, where it's like, what are you going to do? Make fun of me? Quit? Not work with me again? I just need to make a great film with you. If we have a good time, we'll make another one. If we don't, I fucking know John Cleese and Eric Idle. I could call them up at any fucking minute.
The most hilarious safety net you will ever have.
Yes.
Yeah. And then I want to talk about the Vertigo homage. Okay, at one point in the movie, Bruce Willis and Madeline Stowe are on the run, and they're hiding out in this dingy little theater that
It's like a porn theater, let's face it.
And yet, what are they showing?
They're showing Vertigo.
They're showing a 24-hour Alfred Hitchcock marathon.
Yes.
A Hitchcock marathon at what is clearly a porn theater. That is the Gilliam world that I want to live in. And so they're watching...
Really? You want to live in a Gilliam world where you go to a porn theater and instead watch The Birds?
Have you met me? I would way rather watch Hitchcock than... I mean, I will masturbate to Hitchcock. Don't get me wrong.
That's the image I didn't need. I was trying to avoid that image, and there it is.
And every time we talk about junk food land,
Brian masturbating to The Birds.
Well, it's actually mostly rope, and I'm choking myself. Rope. Funny. Autoerotic asphyxiation is always...
Oh, by the way, that's the point where the rest of you out there are supposed to be laughing.
Yeah. See, that's why I don't have Eric Idle and John Cleese as a hilarious safety net. So anyway, so they're in the theater and they're watching Vertigo, and Bruce Willis, they're putting on disguises, and Bruce Willis falls asleep. And when he wakes up, he can't find Madeline Stowe, and he runs panicked out into the lobby. And when he sees her, oh my God, I love the way they do this. When he sees her, you hear the strains of Bernard Herrmann's gorgeous score from Vertigo, and it swells just as he sees her, and all of a sudden she's wearing a blonde wig, because famously all of Hitchcock's leading ladies were blondes, or he preferred blondes.
Yeah.
And not only that, but it is a complete mirror of the scene in Vertigo where Kim Novak has completely transformed herself at the behest of Jimmy Stewart, and she comes out and she's blonde and she's wearing the dress, and it's this very, like, supernatural, beautiful, romantic moment, and it's completely mirrored in this scene. And what's great about that is that, like, we talked about the fact that that this movie, that 12 Monkeys, is inspired by La Jetée. La Jetée itself was inspired by Vertigo. Yeah. So you have Vertigo to La Jetée, 12 Monkeys from La Jetée referencing Vertigo.
There we is.
The serpent eating its tail.
And it is a time travel movie of a big circle.
Yes.
You know, it is a story of a boy who witnesses a guy being shot down, and then we go through time and see that actual event from the other perspective, and that is 12
Monkeys. How beautiful and tragic is it when you find out what that is?
And, well,
And when you find out exactly what that moment is and what that represents for that
and then
boy.
You tie in the image from, you know, the not only the art, but from what this movie is, where it's the 12 monkeys, where it's all the monkeys linked together and it's all one big circle.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this movie is. And yeah, no, this movie is perfect. There is not a single element in this movie that I could say, you know, as we usually do, you know, it could be better. You know, it's kind of funny. You know what we need to forgive? You can't do that with 12 Monkeys.
Yeah.
12 Monkeys is a movie that once you've gone through and picked it apart and taken it apart like an engine and put it back together, you're just like, holy shit. How did any human being make this? This is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
It is fantastic. It is just amazing science fiction. And I think... among, I would easily say the best top 10 science fiction of all time, probably top 5.
Yeah. No, this is an amazing film. And this is a film, like I said, that keeps a lot of different story threads running simultaneously and never misses a beat, never contradicts itself, never really has, like, I watched it twice. Before the show, and I watched it the second time specifically looking for plot holes, specifically looking for moments where things start to unravel and it doesn't quite, but I never found one.
No, because you actually see the picture with Bruce Willis in the past before. You're just not focused on it because you're paying attention to the guy in the foreground.
Yeah.
And you don't realize that there's fucking Bruce Willis on the screen at this fucking moment. When you go back and watch, you're like, holy shit.
Right.
It is so good.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's, yeah, there are no holes here.
Well, and it's again, the parallel to Vertigo is very fascinating because Vertigo was that movie for Hitchcock that people have called his flawless masterpiece. And yet at the same time, it was very ambitious. It was very different. And it just did not get the same love as his other movies. Now, obviously, Terry Gilliam is somebody who's made brilliant movies his whole career and had that problem his whole career, yeah, that his movies just... don't reach mainstream audiences.
Well, he's not a mainstream director.
No, not at all. But here again, I feel like 12 Monkeys is a flawless movie. It's a movie that, as ambitious as it is and as technical as it is, so many opportunities to fall apart, so many opportunities for things not to work, and yet that never happens.
Yeah.
And again, once you get to the end of the... And I was going to talk about the ending movie, but I think I'm just going to leave it.
No.
I'm going to leave it.
Yeah, there's no reason to... Really, there's nothing we can parse apart that we haven't already discussed.
Yeah.
And if for some reason you have not watched this movie, we have actually managed to avoid a number of the big spoilers. You need to watch this movie fucking immediately, and then you need to turn around and watch it again. It is that kind of a fucking movie. It is just solid, pure, unadulterated cinema.
And you can play a drinking game called Count the Crazy, where every time you encounter a new form of crazy in the movie, you take yourself a little drink.
And eventually you die.
Well, eventually every rambling of every lunatic in the movie is going to start making sense to you because you will be stone cold drunk.
Yes.
Which is, as we have...
And then they'll remove your liver.
Well, yeah, but as we've found in the process of recording these shows, it's not always the worst thing in the world.
No.
May I have another beer, please?
Yes.
Okay. It's all in good fun, all in good fun.
Well, that brings us to the junk food pairing, and for this, I could think of nothing better.
Is it the monkey brain from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom?
It is not the monkey brain from Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. I went with a big old box of animal crackers. Giraffes, bears, gorillas, and yes, also monkeys, all gathered together in a cardboard cage, waiting to be released by Brad Pitt and his army of the 12 monkeys. As you munch away, staring at the bleak post-virus wasteland, or possibly the walls of your cell, you too can begin to wonder whether you are living in a post-apocalypse and pine for the ability to travel back to the before time, the long, long ago, or whether you might just be cracking up. Animal crackers, your junk food pairing for 12 monkeys.
I'm going to have the monkey brain.
Of course, you have your chilled monkey brain. Well, that's going to do it for this week's show. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you have been enjoying the March Madness series that we've been doing. We've got a couple more in this series that I think you're really going to enjoy. I'm really glad that there are 5 Tuesdays in March because it gives us the opportunity to really explore this theme in depth, and it's been a lot of fun so far, and I have no doubt that you guys are going to enjoy what we have coming up on deck. In the meantime, I want to let you know that all of our episodes are available on iTunes as well as on Stitcher. You can also follow us on Twitter @JunkFoodCinema and like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/, you guessed it, Junk Food Cinema. Cargill, where can people find you on the internet?
You can find me at twitter.com/massaworm. That's MASSAWYRM. Or at Hotmail. Hotmail.
On hotmail.old.
What's hotmail.old? At facebook.com/massaworm. MASSAWYRM.
/GeoCities.
Angel fire, baby.
Spinning gifts. All the spinning gifts you can possibly want. You can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me on Facebook. My page is facebook.com/BryanSalisburyCritic. And you can also find me over at oneofus.net, my home away from home. A lot of great geek podcasts and blogs over there. And we are in the throes of our South by Southwest coverage, so definitely stay tuned to the website and all the fun stuff that we are doing here in Austin during that film festival. So glad we recorded this beforehand, because we would have no time to do so in the middle of South by. But
we would have to go through South By and then build a time machine, a time tunnel, and travel back in time to try to prevent us from missing the podcast.
What? That's amazing.